Hello and Freilich and Chanukah. I'm glad to have this opportunity to share some insights with you about such a well-known story. The story of the Syrian Greeks who came to persecute the Jews in Judea. The Hashmonaim, the Hasmoneans, fought back. They won. They found the temple had been defiled, but they found one flask of oil and lit the menorah, which miraculously burned for 8 days. And so we eat latkes, and we sing, and we play dreidel, say hallel. And for many, that's about it. There are, however, so many deeper levels to the story, and I would like to focus on a lesser-known part of it, and that is exactly when did the revolt come about and what prompted it. I also would like to examine another aspect of Chanukah, in that it is unusual that the observance that everybody has, that of lighting the first night one candle, and then the second night two candles, and three candles, and so on and so forth, until the eight candles on the eight nights, is in fact the practice of the Mahadrin min ha-Mahadrin, those who wanted to do things in an extra, specially beautiful way. And that's very unusual that the, so to speak, big chumrah, the extra stringent practice, should be the one that everybody, even the most simple Jews, are keeping at that level. There are many, many people who've commented on that, and most of the time the reasons that are brought are that it has to do with that we're trying to do the mitzvahs very beautifully, since the Greeks represented beauty and we wanted to overcome their beauty by doing our mitzvah as beautifully as possible, and many, many other beautiful insights. I really don't want to focus on that. What I would like to talk to you about is the basic mitzvah. And the basic mitzvah, according to the Gemara in Shabbos, is ner ish ubeso. One candle per home, per day. That's it. The Chanukah box of candles that you would get would be much smaller. 8 candles, maybe 16 if you had one in one Shabbos every day. Just the one candle. What did this represent, and what was the thinking of our sages when they wanted to institute the one candle? Why is that the most basic level of the mitzvah, and it's only when we want to do it more superlatively that we go into the other way of doing it? I think in order to look at this, we should look back at the period in which the Chanukah story happened. It was a period of religious persecution, which happened really over a considerable amount of time. It didn't happen overnight that the Syrian Greeks came in and there was a revolt. Over a considerable number of years, the Greeks came in and began to influence the Jews in Judea. And when the Greeks came in, it was an overnight sensation. It was a radical departure from anything that anyone in Judea had seen. In fact, it was a radical departure from anything the world had ever seen. The Greeks were perhaps the greatest advent of modernity and progress in all of human history. From a relatively primitive time in the world before, we had theater, art, sport, sculpture, dialectics, beauty, painting, thoughts, philosophy, all sorts of unbelievably beautiful and advanced and progressive ideas, and it took the world by storm. Of course, all of us look back and we've learned about it as the cradle of Western civilization, and the Greek culture truly did have its great moments. And when it came to Judea, there were many, many Jews who found the lure of the new way of looking at things, the new way of culture and the way of worshiping their gods that went along with it. They found that irresistible. Unfortunately, a large part of Klal Yisrael became what was known as Mityavnim, Hellenists, those who became like the Greeks. And they went along not only with the beauty of Greece, but also with another part of it, which was not so positive, which was a very aggressive attempt of the Greeks, not only to show us their culture, but to smother us with it. As we say in the Al-Hanisim prayer, Lahashkicham Torasecha ulaha'avira mechukei ritzunecha, to make us forget about the Torah, to make us forget about our laws, forget about our ways of doing things, to forget about our relationship with God, to come and update and to join the modern world of progress that had come so far beyond what was then almost a 1,500-year-old, ancient, hopelessly out-of-date culture, according to the Greeks. And in order to do that, they had a series of laws that they tried to institute to encourage the Jews to go along with their program. At first, they started outlawing only several things. Practice of Shabbos, of course, the central practice to the Jewish people. Mila, the rite of circumcision. And Rosh Chodesh, that special institution by which we have a special meeting with Hashem once a month in a very special way. They wanted us to stop that. That didn't succeed in getting a stubborn core of people to go along. And although their culture more and more became a part of what was going on in Judea, nevertheless, that core was still stubbornly resisting embracing the culture of the Greeks. So they stepped it up a notch. Now it was forbidden to study Torah. And of course, that had a tremendous effect. But then, at a certain point, they came out with some very strange decrees, according to the Midrash. Three in particular. The Midrash reports that they decreed that any home with a central beam must be knocked down. Furthermore, that any woman who wanted to enter into matrimony, who was to be a bride, first she had to succumb to the local Hellenist official who was known as the hegemon prior to her wedding. And third, that the Jews had to write on the horn of an ox, "I have no share in the God of Israel." Central beams, the woman with the hegemon, horns of oxes. What could they have in mind? What was Plato thinking? I don't know if Plato personally was involved, but what were the Greeks thinking in these decrees? Well, one way of understanding this was that, as happened many times in Jewish history, the bulwark, those who at the end were able to prevent the degradation of the Jewish people in its most trying moments, were the women. From the story of Korach, the story of the golden calf, throughout the book of Bereishis, and so many other times when the men might have gone here, might have gone there, it was the women who were the, as the psalmist says, "Benosenu kizavios mechutavos tavnis hecho." They are as firm as the corners of a building. They aren't bendable. They know their true core. And the Greeks realized that unless we do something about these women and break them down, we would not be able to ultimately gain our aim of changing the whole character of the Jewish people. And so they attacked the Jewish women. They focused on the Akeret HaBayit, the core of the home. And they said that the core of each home, as represented by the central beam of that home, could not be allowed to stand, and any home with a central beam had to be broken down. The Greeks knew by trial and error that no matter what their Madison Avenue of Athens threw at the Jewish people at the time, the women were preventing the men from buying it, and they were sure that they had to break down those women's will. And they attacked the home. And they attacked the effect that the women had on their children. I heard in the name of Rabbi Lev Gorwitz that he went to visit the British Museum, and in the British Museum you could see that one of the early innovations of the Greeks were that they used to use the ox's horn as a baby bottle. That was the first Gerber version, where they would use that horn, hollow it out, and use that as a device to feed the children. In such a nefarious and subversive way, the Greeks attacked that most beautiful and pure of all human activities, the feeding of the young by their mothers. They insisted that they get in the way, and that the transfer of food to the smallest children had to be done in a way in which the Jews were forced to proclaim that they had no share in the God of Israel. Again, trying to break down the very institution of motherhood and the centrality of the Jewish woman. And finally, the institution of marriage, in that they forced women to submit to the hegemon. The Midrash in Maase Chanukah brings down an incredible story, which is not well known, but is really at the core of when the revolt actually happened. And I will read it with you. Kevan shero yivanim she'en Yisrael margishin b'gzeros sehem. When the Greeks saw that the Jews were still not feeling the full effect of their decrees, Amdu v'gazru aleihem gezera mora v'achura. They came and decreed upon them a terrible and bitter decree. Shaloti kanes kala belaila harishon mechupasa, ella etzel hahegmon shebemakamahu. That a bride on the first night, when she was going to go into the chuppah, into the marital canopy, had to first submit to the hegemon in that place. Kivan sheshamu Yisrael kach. When the Jewish people heard this at first, rafu yideihem, they weakened their hands, v'toshash kocham, and their strength was drained, v'nimne'u mila'areis, and they stopped getting engaged, stopped getting married. V'hoyu benos Yisrael bogros umaskinos kishehen besulos. And Jewish women would get older and come into maturity and get old, still as virgins. V'niskayem aleihem, and upon them, it was fulfilled, the verse that's said in the Book of Lamentations in Echa, Besuloseha Nugos Vihimarla, that it, her young virgins were sad and it was so bitter for it. Vahayu Yivanim mit alalos bibesulos Yisrael. And they were in this way trifling with the young women of Israel. Vinahagu bedavar hazeh shalosh shanim ushmona chadashim. And 3 years and 8 months came upon. And after those 3 years and 8 months, people started to get used to this idea. In fact, that became somewhat of the norm. Anyone who's a student of the Gemara and Kesubas, where we are in the middle of the Daf Yomi, knows that the first Mishnah of Kesubas says, Besula Nises Liyom Revi, that the women would get married on the fourth day in an attempt to fool the hegemon, because the hegemon was expecting them to get married on the fifth day, so sometimes they could sneak it in the fourth day and not get caught. Nevertheless, all too many times, it became the norm, and that people realized that was just how life was, and they'd have to get used to it, much as they had gotten used to so much of the Greek culture and the Greek depravity that had overtaken their country. And an incredible story happened. Until the story of the daughter of Matisyahu himself, who was Niseis Leven Chashmonai, she was getting married to somebody in the Chashmonian family, Vel Azar Hayashemo, named Elazar. So, Kevan Shehigia Yom Simchasa, came the day of the wedding, Hoshivihu Apapai Puryon, they placed her in the place where the Kalot usually came. Ukeshahigia zman ha'seuda niskabtzu kol gedolei Yisrael lechavod Matisyahu uben Chashmonai shelo hayu bo so hador gedolei mehem. All the Jewish people, the greatest sages, they all came to come to this wedding, and it was very public. And of course, the Greeks had heard about it too. And what was going to happen? Basically, they knew that the hegemon was going to show up, and before the wedding was consummated, at first, the kala would be escorted into a side room, and that cruel hegemon would have his way with the kala. And then the wedding would go on. And you can just imagine the scene. There's a shmorg. There's a band playing in the background. Everybody's dressed up. Everybody's festive. It's a wedding. It's a wonderful day. Part of the wedding, unfortunately, is this rape that's going to happen to this daughter of Matisyahu. But look, you know, that's the way it is. Was kementon. What can you do? That's just the way it is right now. Life has to go on. Kishi yashvu lisod, when they sat down to eat, amda chana bas Matisyahu me'al apiryon. This chana bat Matisyahu, this kala, stood up from her bridal chair, v'safku kapeha zu al zu. She clapped her hands, called attention. V'kara parpuan shela. She ripped off her clothes. V'amda lifnei kol Yisrael kishehi megula. And she stood bare, naked as the day she was born, in front of all of the Jewish people, in front of all the great rabbis. V'lifnei aviha v'ima v'chosna. And in front of her mother and her father and her in-laws. Kemen shero acheha kach nisbaishu. Her brothers, Yehuda, Shimon, saw this. They got terribly embarrassed. What happened to our sister? Natnu pnehem bakarka. They've looked down. V'karu bigdehem. They ripped their clothes. V'amdu aleha lahorga. And they were about to get up and kill her. How could you do this to us? How could you embarrass the family with us? What's the matter with you? Amar lahem, she said to them, Shimoni, listen to me, Achyai v'dodai, my brothers, my uncles, my cousins. Umayim bishvil sha'amadati lifnei tzadikim aruma. And if I stood here before saintly people and I was naked, but belish shum avera, without, I haven't done anything wrong otherwise. I haven't sinned. Hare atem mitkanim bi, this you're so jealous about me. Ve'ein atem mitkanim limosrani biyad areh lehitalel bi. And about the fact that I'm about to go into that uncircumcised brute, you don't care about that? The fact that he's going to rape me, that you're not doing anything? You're sitting here and eating? Halo yesh lachem lumod mi Shimon v'Levi achei Dina. Shouldn't you learn from Shimon and Levi, the brothers of Dina? Shelo hayu ela shnayim. They were only the two of them. V'kin ula achosam. And they were so zealous about their sister, v'hargu krach kishchem. And they went and they killed the whole town of Shechem because of that rape. U'masru nafshom al yichud shel makom. And they gave over their lives. They were willing to sacrifice everything to make sure that the right would stand and that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's honor would be revenged. Ve'ezram Hashem v'lo hichlimam, and Hashem helped them. Vateb chamishachim, you are five brothers, Yehuda, Yochanan, Yonatan, Shimon, Elazar, Upirche Kohuna Yotami Mosaim Bachur, and 200 other younger Kohanim. Simu bitchonchem alamakom, trust in God, v'hu ya'azoretchem, and surely He will help you. Shne'emar, as it says, ki ein ma'atzor la'Hashem lo'Hoshia, nothing stops in the way of Hashem to help you, if you truly believe it and if you truly work towards it. Upatcha piha bivichya, and she opened her mouth with cries. V'amran, she said, Ribono shel olam, Master of the Universe, im lo tachos aleinu, if you're not going to have pity on us, chus al kedusha shimcha hagadol, at least have mercy on the degradation and the desecration of your great name, which is called upon us, unekom hayom es nikmosenu, and avenge this terrible act that is being done against us. It was at that moment that finally woke up the brothers. V'amru, and they said, Ba'u v'nitol etza manaseh, and let's think about what we can do here. Natlu nai etza zemizeh, they got together and they made a plan. V'amru, and they said, Ba'u v'nikacha choseinu, let us take our sister, come and bring her etzel hamelech hagodol. We won't go just to this local hegmon over here, but we're going to go to the king himself in Omarlo, and we'll say to him, Achoseinu, our sister, Bas Kohen Gadol, she's the daughter of the Kohen Gadol, Matisyahu, Ein b'chal Yisrael gadol mi'avinu, he's the greatest amongst us. V'ra'inu shel talina choseinu im hagmon, it's not right that he should sleep with this hegmon, elem hamelech shu gadol kamoseinu, she is fit for the king himself. V'nichnesnu alav, and then we brought it into him, v'nagagehu, and they will kill him, v'natchilachakach ba'avodav, v'vesorav, and then we'll take care of his servants and with his ministers, v'Hashem yazreinu v'yisagvenu, and surely Hashem will help us. Natlueitza, they followed this advice, they executed the plan, v'asalahem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, teshua gedola, and Hashem made for them a tremendous redemption. V'shamu baskol mibeis kodesh HaKadoshim. And they heard a voice emanating from the holiest of holies, Kol Yisrael Nitzchu. The Jewish people, all of them, have truly been victorious. Ken Yaseh HaMakom Yeshua B'Yameinu, so shall Hashem make a redemption in our days. An amazing story of how the revolt of Hanukkah started. What was the final straw that broke the back of the complacency that people had gotten used to and ready to just live with? The idea that the Greeks could take over their culture. That's when it all turned around. Incredible as this story is, there's a deeper level to the story. If you noted, the voice from heaven emanated from the Kodesh HaKadoshim, from the very Holy of Holies. And in fact, the whole story came about through the work of Matisyahu, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. The Maharal of Prague says that it could only have come about through the Kodesh HaKadoshim and through the Kohen Gadol, because there's a major difference between Kodesh and Kodesh Kodoshim. Kodesh, as we say every Motzei Shabbat and Saturday night, Kodesh and Chol do not mix. You either have Kodesh or you have Chol. You either have the holy or you have the profane. Both cannot coexist. It's like Or v'choshech, light and darkness. It's either light or it's dark. You can't have both. But that's at the level of Kodesh. There's a deeper level, which is Kodesh Kodeshim, which is akin to the deeper level of light and darkness. For in reality, there is no such thing as darkness. There is no creation called darkness. What there is light and absence of light. And even in the darkest places, there is some light, just a very low level of light. Even if the darkest, deepest recesses of the universe, there is some level of light, as has been proven often in the most recent exciting experiments having to do with the Big Bang. There's light everywhere, not often visible, but it's there. And the Maharal says that the light, which represents Kodesh, sometimes Chol, sometimes the profane, can overpower it. And in particular, the light that was represented by the Kodesh in the Beit HaMikdash, by the section of the Holy Temple that was only referred to as the outer sanctuary, the Kodesh, the Greeks were able to overpower that. He says an interesting gematria, an interesting numerical value, that the value of Yavan is 66, which is one more than the gematria of Heichal, which is only 65. But at a deeper level, the Kodesh Kodashim is even greater. The Kodesh Kodashim is that part of holiness that can never be sullied by the decadence of the world, no matter how deep. The Kodesh Kodashim is the most inner sanctum, which comes directly from Hashem himself, and of course everything that comes directly from Hashem himself is Kodesh Kodashim, is ultimately untouchable by the forces of darkness. And that Kodesh Kodashim can overcome Yavan. For each Jew, the Holy of Holies is our home. Not our shuls, not our yeshivas. Those are very holy. But the holiest of holy places in Jewish life is the home. It's in the home where Jewish life happens in the real world. It's in the home where we can truly have Kedusha, holiness, at the deepest levels. And in the inner sanctum of our home, the intimate life that we have is to be as sacred as possible. It's interesting that when we get married, the blessing that our sages instituted was Mekadesh Amo Yisrael Al Yedei Chupa VeKedushin, that God sanctifies the Jewish people through the institutions of marriage, chuppah, and kiddushin. That is the only bracha like that in all of our liturgy. There's no other mitzvah that Mekadesh Amo Yisrael Al Yedei Achilas Matzah, or that God sanctified us through eating matzah, or through putting on tefillin, or whatever. It's only through chuppah v'kiddushin. That is the one particular Jewish institution which is the ultimate source of our holiness. The Greeks tried to attack that source, but that source was impenetrable to them. That source is the ultimately, when they went to attack that source, that is the thing that went and got up again and bit them and started the whole revolt that eventually got rid of them. It was Ish Ubeito, man in his home, man and woman and their family, their inner sanctum, that special Kedusha. That is where it all started. And yes, afterwards became greater and went out into the world, and we had Pirsumei Nisa, and we publicized it, and we do it in a Mahadran way, and a Mahadran min a Mahadran, in which we try to let the whole world know and bring the holiness of that inner holiness to the whole world, to places far removed from our inner sanctum. But the bottom line, where it starts, is Ishu Beito, in that inner sanctum. Let us surely resolve on Hanukkah to make sure that our homes be in fact an inner sanctum. That whatever goes on in the outside world, whatever decadence and tumah we experience, whatever spiritual challenges we face, the home should be a home of sanctity, of Kedusha. At my chuppah, my wife and I had the great privilege of having Ramosha Eisenman Shlita of Baltimore as our Masada Kedusha. And he said something I'll never forget. He said that we wish a Chasan and Kala often that they should have a bayis ne'eman bi Yisrael, a home that is loyal in Israel. What is a loyal home? A loyal home is one which is just that, loyal. You know and you can trust that everything in there is loyal, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu could come into that home and feel comfortable in that home. And by what is in that home and what is not in that home, about the way people behave and the way they refrain from behaving, that it truly bespeaks holiness, beauty, pleasantness, and the true idea of Kedusha, of holiness. May we all merit to have that forever in our lives as we celebrate this wonderful Yontif of Chanukah and remember where it all started, how it all came to be, and how that this institution lets us know that Hadneras Halalu Kodeshem, these lights bring holiness into our homes forevermore. Afreilichen Chanukah.